I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. The midterm election's just days away, and Ballot 2014 coverage continues on Intersection with a conversation about Central Florida's U.S. House District 9. I'll ask incumbent Alan Grayson, a Democrat, and Carol Platt, his Republican challenger, about their stance on U.S. foreign policy, healthcare, and the economy. That's ahead on Intersection. I sat down with Carol Platt in the studio. I began by asking her what she thinks of the United States' involvement in helping combat the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and Syria.
We are lacking a comprehensive plan in order to protect Americans and to put into control this type of extremist group. And I'm concerned that we have the potential of putting American soldiers in harm's way without a positive plan to be successful.
What would you suggest to do, you know, not taking the step to put troops on the ground in that part of the world, but try and defeat this combatant?
It's going to take an incredibly comprehensive approach. It can't be just airstrikes. It's going to have to be comprehensive in terms of diplomacy, in terms of working with the various nations in the Middle East, and working with our allies around the globe. This is an extremely serious threat.
Do you think the United States should be getting involved in this crisis in Syria and Iraq?
Yes. I think that our national security is at risk, and I think the lives of the people around the world are at risk. This is a type of terrorism that's exported not just to us but to other nations, and it's going to require not only the response of the United States but a global response.
Do you think your constituents appreciate that, or do you think there's sometimes a tendency to say, look, it's happening thousands of miles away, it doesn't concern us, why should we be involved?
Our community is incredibly diverse. Our citizens were born in multiple countries, and the people that visit us here as our number one economic driver is tourism, are from all over the world. So I think our community recognizes that we're not isolated.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the Affordable Care Act. Now, it was passed this year with the aim of increasing the quality and affordability of health insurance, whether it went into effect this year. Republicans obviously opposed to aspects of the legislation, if not the entire thing. Where do you stand on the Affordable Care Act?
The Affordable Care Act basically began to offer some insurance to people who were not insured. Some. We had approximately 30% of the nation that needs to be better insured and have better health care. In the process of the Affordable Care Act, we have damaged the affordability and the availability of insurance and the quality of insurance for about 70% of Americans. I would say that's not a positive answer for the people that live here. It's not a good solution. And I think we can find a better solution that provides basic health care and improves the health of 30% of the people that were uninsured without destroying that for 70% of the people that were.
Where does the 70% figure come from?
Those are numbers that come across from the origination of why we needed the insurance, because and why we needed to make some reforms to health care. I think that we really missed the mark in putting the program together. And I've met with numerous people who have been able to get insurance that weren't. And I've met with people who have a loss of insurance policies, people who can't afford the insurance that are there, people whose insurance has been basically, it's just declined in what can be covered. People have lost their doctors. People who, in the structure of how the dollars were allocated, have lost their quality of even the Medicare that they were on. They've had situations where vendors are changed erratically. They are not notified. They are moved. I've talked to veterans who were moved from one facility that was within 15 minutes of their home to a two-hour drive.
And you're saying this is a result of the ACA?
Yes, and most of this program has not even been enacted yet. And that's one of the issues, is this executive order as to what portions of legislation will be implemented and what will not. If we were in a position where when you pass legislation, it has to be implemented, then several years ago, this would have been addressed. And when I've talked to the numbers of people from the hospitals to the specialty physicians to the physician's assistants, allied health, trades, nursing, and also to the patients, where I think we failed is we did not have all the stakeholders at the table. And I don't think that simply repealing is good enough. This has to be replaced with a patient-centered program. And there's some great ideas out there, and people are ready to come to the table.
So you would say the majority of people you talk to about the Affordable Care Act, they're not happy with it?
Oh, not at all. I've talked to corporations. One in particular, healthcare costs have increased by 42% in 2 years. That's prevented that company from being able to give raises to their employees. And they're looking at the next year. They've been able to hold on with those increased rates to health care insurance for their employees. But they've done that because they care about them and they care about their families. At the same time, it's very difficult to keep up with market wages whenever you have to incur that sort of increased cost. And they're sitting there not knowing how to expand their business, not hiring new employees, being careful about part-time. And they're forced with, when this is fully implemented, making decisions that will either lower the health care that they're providing to their employees or eliminate it altogether. Or basically take those employees, put more work on to them because you can't hire new people, or it can very easily go into a situation that Canada has where everyone works part-time, which means everyone works two jobs.
Everyone in Canada works part-time?
Not everyone, but there's a large percentage of Canada that they are realizing that you have permanent part-time positions, more so than full-time. And that doesn't help families at all. There's numerous families and also young people. They're coming out of college. They can't find jobs. They're heavily in debt. And they're having to work positions that do not require the college degree. And some of them are working two and three jobs. I hear that from young people all the time. I hear that from families.
Let's talk about the economy, because District 9, the district that you would be serving, includes areas that are suffering from some of the problems you mentioned, like people having to work more than one job, the kinds of jobs which might not necessarily include benefits, and there's obviously an issue with homelessness in some parts of District 9. What kind of strategies would you take if you were elected to increase wages and jobs in the area?
The most important step forward that we could take is within a free market system, within a free market economy, and begin to unleash the potential of the private sector. Our homeless issue in this district is great. And the community has begun to band together, not point fingers, but band together in order to begin to solve this. It's a remnant of the downturn in the economy. And we have not bounced back. We are simply steadily stable. And the next step is to help these families through a variety of options. And that comes from the availability of jobs And when you unleash that economy, then you're going to get market wages, and you're going to get companies that are going to be in the area for a while, and you're going to have the ability to use higher education as a bridge to retrain people and get people back on their feet. Housing, of course, is a very important portion of this.
How would you attract some of those higher-paying jobs? When you talk about unleashing the potential of the private sector, but do you have any specifics in mind?
This area has tremendous potential. We have great opportunities in our natural resources. We have a good combination between tourism industry and the agriculture industry, which is, of course, second in the district. 70% of this district is in agriculture lands. And it's a very important source of the economy whenever you are able to provide food not only to your region, particularly in cases of emergency, but also long-term to the world. And with that, we are missing a manufacturing sector, and we are missing some high-tech sectors. Now, there have been strides in reaching those, but so many of those high-tech jobs are very much dependent upon a community structure. We have to have good schools. We have to have good roads and good transportation. And we have to have streamlined regulations and processes in order for that business to establish and to grow. And one of the issues is overregulation.
Let me ask you one other question related to employment. And Orange County started a debate about sick time and mandatory paid sick time. Where do you stand, Carol Platt, on a statewide or even a national initiative to offer sick time to employees?
I think that having paid sick time is certainly a marketable benefit. But making it mandatory can affect the market in a negative way.
Finally, you've labeled your opponent as divisive. Why do you think that?
The type of statements that come from our current congressman tend to throw gasoline on fire instead of being able to calm people and come to reason. Then those types of comments, they divide people. Whether they're divided by ethnicity or whether they're divided by income levels or whether they're divided by cities from counties, counties from each other. We have three wonderful counties in this district, Orange, Osceola, and Polk. And whenever your first reaction is to denigrate, that's not positive. And it certainly, I don't think, is a reflection of the people that live here in this community. We're good people, and we deserve better than that.
There's talk about the fact that Congress itself is divided. There isn't a lot of bipartisanship. What would you do to try and reach across the aisle if you were elected to this position?
I have a good track record of doing that. And I think the most important thing you can do is to go to D.C. representing the people that live here, not just the people of your own party, but the people of both parties and all parties.
I've been speaking to U.S. Congressional District 9 candidate Carol Platt. Carol, thank you very much for speaking to me.
Enjoyed it.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. You can join the conversation on our Facebook page or send us a tweet at WMFE Orlando. Up next, I speak to Congressman Alan Grayson. I spoke to U.S. Congressional District 9 Representative Alan Grayson by phone. I began by asking Grayson what he thinks about the U.S. approach to combating the so-called Islamic State.
I think that most people realize that we're just at risk of being sucked into yet another endless Middle East war. It's obviously going to be a quagmire for us. I think it already is, and it has been. What we need is a new strategy. I've come up with a new strategy, and I've tried to get the ball rolling. I think that what we need is to have the local countries involved in the Middle East, the Sunni countries with substantial standing armies, to get together and fight Islamic radicalism themselves. They're the ones who are actually threatened by it, not just in Syria and in Iraq, but throughout the entire region. So I, as a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee, directly contacted 10 ambassadors from other Sunni countries in the region and asked them if they would participate in such a an international armed force to defeat ISIS. Of the 10, 3 said yes, and of the remaining 7, we got a variety of different responses, ranging from we'll think about it to no. But I think that's a good start, and it's far better than seeing, once again, the United States take the entire burden when everyone else just lays off and sees our soldiers and our money being wasted.
What sort of extent would you see the United States getting involved, just taking a sort of remote hands-off approach, or would you see any boots on the ground at all?
Well, we have certain capabilities that other countries in the area don't have. For instance, none of the other countries in the area can actually employ drone attacks. But it's clear that ISIS will not be defeated unless there are boots on the ground. I think that's obvious to anybody who's had any sort of informed view of this, whether or not they sit in the same classified group briefings that I do. And where are those boots going to come from? The Iraqi army is useless. Syria is in the midst of a civil war. My solution is really the only practical solution to the problem. If we don't do that, then we'll see ISIS win. And so the thing is to get the United States to be sort of a catalyst to see that international force assembled. And bear in mind that if there is a local international force assembled, then those soldiers will have much better opportunities to be to work with the locals and to defeat ISIS than what will be seen as an occupying force. The local soldiers are Muslims, for the most part. The local soldiers speak the language there, for the most part. The local soldiers understand the local customs and the religion in a way that, frankly, we had a lot of difficulty doing when we were occupying Iraq and now Afghanistan. It's much more difficult for an American soldier to simply understand what is going on around him, much less create constructive liaisons with the local population, than it is, let's say, for an Egyptian soldier or for a soldier from the United Arab Emirates.
Why do you think it is, Congressman, that local forces weren't able to defeat ISIS when it first sort of swept through that area?
Well, the simple answer is that the Iraqi army is useless. We spent $24 billion training the Iraqi army of U.S. taxpayer funds. In addition to that, the Iraqi government has the benefit of $100 billion a year in oil revenue. At the beginning of this fight, the Iraqi army outnumbered the ISIS soldiers by 100 to 1. And they simply ran scared and ran away whenever there was any sort of confrontation. One example I've given to people, which is quite stark, is that one Iraqi town was approached by a small band of ISIS soldiers with a bullhorn. And they shouted through the bullhorn to a much larger Iraqi army force, "We're coming in. We're coming in 2 hours. You better get the heck out." And sure enough, they did. So there you have it. I mean, the new weapon of mass destruction in the Middle East is a bullhorn.
And YouTube, it seems.
Yeah, that's another good example.
Do you think voters in your congressional district are concerned with these things happening in the Middle East, or is that not something that they're going to be thinking about going to the polls?
They're not thinking about it. I know exactly how our voters feel, and they are way, way more interested in paid sick leave than they are in ISIS. They are way more interested in an increase in the minimum wage than they are in ISIS. We unfortunately here in Orlando have the lowest wages in the entire country. Of the 50 largest metropolitan areas, Orlando is 50th in average pay. 40% of our workers in Orlando make less than $12 an hour. So they have things much more direct on their minds than what's going on in Syria or Iraq. And I'm very much aware of that, and I try very hard to keep that in mind and make progress whenever we can with regard to pay and benefits and health care, which is what's really on the minds of people locally.
Aside from raising the minimum wage, what other thoughts do you have about trying to boost the economy, create more high-paying jobs in your congressional district?
Well, our congressional district basically has three economic drivers. One is tourism, and I passed the Travel Promotion Act in my first term in Congress and then renewed it in my second term of Congress. to drive that. The Travel Promotion Act puts a fee on visas for people coming to the United States, and then uses that fee to promote visitors from other countries to travel to the United States. And of course, the number one destination is Orlando. The number one destination of travelers from all around the world to the United States is Orlando. And throughout the state of Florida, we have 70 million visitors a year. So that's the number one driver, and that's one thing that I've done to try to promote that. I can give you some other examples, but I think you get the idea. Mm-hmm. The second great promoter locally is senior services, including healthcare. With regard to senior services, I am the leading proponent in Congress of expanding Medicare. I believe that Medicare should cover eyeglasses, hearing aids, dental needs. I've introduced a bill called the Seniors Have Eyes, Ears, and Teeth Act to remind people that seniors have eyes, ears, and teeth, and that if we're going to say that we're going to cover their health care needs through Medicare, we should mean it, and we should make sure that that care is comprehensive. Last year, when there was an effort to cut Social Security and Medicare benefits, I led the charge against that, gathered 3 million petition signatures on a petition that I wrote against any and every Social Security and Medicare cut. Why? Well, first, because seniors deserve that, and secondly, because we need that for our local economy. To the extent that seniors have a full panoply of benefits and they get their Social Security the way that they're supposed to, that helps to drive the local economy. In my district, 16% of the people who live are seniors. That number grows almost every year. So that's important, too. Our third driver is housing. I've been a proponent of relaxing the rules to qualify for a government-backed loan for the entire time that I've been in Congress. I pushed that very hard when I was on the Financial Services Committee in my first term. I want everybody to be able to, if they possibly can, afford to have their own home and be part of the American dream. Also to keep it once they've got it, I came up with an anti-foreclosure plan that was adopted, called the Mandatory Mediation Program, that was adopted in my first term in 2009, prevailed upon our local judges to accept it. It cut foreclosures in Orange County in half, from over 3,000 to less than 1,500 each month. And it was so successful that it was adopted statewide until Governor Scott killed it.
Let me just circle back, if I could, to Medicaid. Obviously, it's the Florida legislature that passed up on federal funds that would expand Medicaid. From the congressional level, is there anything more that you can do to push things back in that direction?
Well, it's shockingly irresponsible, and anybody who's in the medical field, Democratic or Republican, will tell you that. It's denying us $70 billion, with a B, $70 billion of federal money that we're paying for through our taxes anyway. And we have to pay for it whether or not we get that money. And that works out to $3,500 for every single human being, every man, woman, and child in the state in terms of benefits. In addition to that, we still are left with almost 2 million people in the state who are not covered, who cannot see a doctor when they're sick as a result of that decision. And the scientists and epidemiologists tell us that when you have two people who are identical physically, same age, same weight, same gender, same smoking habits, one of them has insurance and the other one doesn't, the one without insurance is 40% more likely to die each year. So we're looking at 2,000 Floridians, including one in my district named Charlene Gill, who die. We're going to die each year, until the Republicans in Tallahassee see the light and decide to accept this free money to provide health care from the government nationally, which we're paying for anyway. Until that point, the blood of those 2,000 people each year in Florida are on their hands.
Let me ask you about sick time. The local sick time initiative in Orange County was defeated. What could be done on the national level to try and move that conversation forward, if that's even possible?
Well, Congressman DeLauro from Connecticut has introduced a bill in Congress, which I'm a co-sponsor of, to try to institute higher labor standards nationally, including that one, to have paid sick leave nationally. If the Democrats had retained our majority in the House and not been defeated by gerrymandering and sewer money from the Koch brothers, then we would have seen that enacted. That was due to come up for consideration before the Koch brothers snatched the House back. Even though the Democrats got 500,000 more votes than the Republicans did, the Republicans nevertheless ended up with 35 more House members because of gerrymandering and that sewer money I referred to earlier. If the Democrats get their majority back, then I think you'll see the DeLauro bill move forward. And the same thing is true with all sorts of different bills that the Republicans have bottled up because they're basically against everything, except possibly corporate tax breaks and corporate welfare. And if the Democrats get our majority back, as we had in 2009 and 2010, you'll start to see bills that are good for the middle class move again.
Just quickly, Congressman, homelessness, that's a problem throughout Florida. Any thoughts on how that problem could be tackled?
Well, many of the homeless are veterans, and we've struggled in our office mightily to try to make sure that the veterans get the benefits that they're entitled to. My office has personally helped over 500 veterans get the benefits that they need in the past 2 years alone. Many of the homeless are the undocumented, almost 10% in Osceola County alone, and perhaps 80,000 in the district as a whole. That's a more difficult problem. I favor a path to citizenship to bring these people out of the shadows and help them to lead the normal lives. I'm an American by birth. These people want to be Americans by choice. And we should recognize what a good thing it will be for everyone involved if they're paying taxes and they have the legal protections that we all take for granted. And, you know, I'm going to be helping them regardless. Slate Magazine indicated earlier this year that I am the most effective member of Congress out of 435 of us. That's not necessarily high kudos in the current competition, but we have done so much locally to help veterans, to help seniors, to keep Kissimmee Airport open, to make sure that Medicare and Social Security benefits remain uncut and untouched.
I want to just ask you a question about the campaign itself. Now, your opponent in this race has said that your comments are like gasoline to a fire and divide people. How do you respond to a comment like that?
Well, it's hypocritical. She's a filthmonger. She has put out all sorts of personal information about me that has nothing to do with my role as a congressman, and it's false, just completely objectively false. She's tried to run this campaign in the gutter, and ultimately the voters will recognize that. But in a larger sense, it just doesn't matter. I think my voters recognize that it's good to have a congressman who gets things done. That's why in 2012 we had the biggest comeback in the history of the U.S. House of Representatives after I was defeated. We won by 25 points in 2012. We have more campaign contributors than any other House member in the entire country. We have over 100,000 people who contribute to our campaign. We have enormous volunteer support. We were able to generate 60,000 volunteer calls in a single day to Democrats in our district urging them to vote. Clearly, the people in my district are very happy with their representation, and understandably so. I look around in the neighboring districts, and what I see is that people come from those districts to our office and say, "My congressman has done nothing for me. Would you please help?"
I've been speaking to U.S. Congressman in District 9, Alan Grayson. He is running for re-election. Thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
The conversation continues on our website, wmfe.org. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. The assistant producer is Brendan Byrne. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.